Hello, everybody. This is Craig D. Lindsay, a.k.a. Uncle Krizzle, a.k.a. Black Larry David, a.k.a. Anastasia Beaverhausen, a.k.a. Cranky Charlie Rose, a.k.a. something. And welcome to an episode of Motherfuckers I Know, the podcast where I talk to motherfuckers I know, because I can do that. And on today's Krizzlecast, I'm talking to somebody all the way from L.A., just a person I've known for quite some time, and actually we'll be spending the next hour discussing stuff. I don't know what yet, but we'll try and figure it out. Adam Villani, welcome to the Krizzlecast, sir.
Well, thank you for welcoming me, Uncle Krizzle. How are you?
Well, my left knee is swollen, but other than that,
yeah, it happens. I mean, my right knee gives me some trouble. I generally take public transit to work, and then it involves climbing and descending a number of stairs, and I try to go out of my way to stick to escalators instead of stairs, just because of the right knee thing.
Old injury or something?
I don't know what it is, really. You know, actually, if I think about it, I think it may have come from sometimes the escalators are broken,
uh-huh.
And so I take the stairs, and my natural inclination is to try to take stairs as fast as I can. Like, I'm like a boom, 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 boom. I always wanted to do that, and I feel that I may have damaged my knee in some way. I went to the doctor. The last time I went to see my general practitioner, she gave me a referral to a physical therapist, and then like a week later, my daughter was born, so I haven't exactly had time to go to a physical therapist since then. Mitch Hedberg, obviously, right? You remember the comedian?
Yeah.
Yeah, he had a famous line about, you know, escalators, if they're broken, it's like, you know, sorry. We have stairs instead, but, you know, a broken escalator, that can actually be a real thing. It can be a pain, especially if you're, like, you know, 50 feet underground and you have to climb up 4 or 5 sets of stairs to get up stairs. But, yeah.
Because Los Angeles, they have those complexes where it's just like 3-4 floors, and you just got to get through them all through, escalators. I mean, I remember going to the Los Angeles Library, having to go all the way down to the basement to look at some stuff, and like a couple of those escalators were not working, so that was an interesting.
I love the Central Library there. It's pretty cool. I love that atrium with all the. You know, all the escalators going down, but yeah, without the escalators, that's kind of a pain. The subway system, there's a difference. I went to Europe for the first time, 2.5 years ago. That's the only time. And, I thought it was kind of amazing on the metro in Paris. Like, first of all, there are many great things about the metro in Paris. I mean, aside from the piecemeal. But, One of the wacky things about it I saw is that it's so shallow. It's like basically just right underneath the surface of the street. I saw people getting cell phone calls on the subway, and that kind of blew my mind because, you know, in Paris it was just cut and cover. They just cut out the street, dug a trench, put the subway in there, and boom, you're ready to go. So it's pretty shallow, and then in L.A., everything is just like deep bore stuff, like, you know, deep beneath the surface, and so above it, you never know it's there.
Okay, so when did you go to Paris?
It was November or October? November. It was November of 2010.
Uh-huh. Was that kind of a vacation?
Yeah. I had never been to Europe. My wife had been, like, in 1998. we ended up spending 4 nights in Belgium, in Brussels, and then 10 nights in Paris. And it was jam-packed with, you know, activities and things to see and that sort of thing. It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I haven't been before, and it'll probably be a while before I go again.
Well, I guess it's a good time to kind of discuss, like, how we got to know each other, because it started when I saw that you had this blog that, like, a friend of mine had on his, you know, blog roll, list of blogs.
Right.
And you had a blog, I believe called Blog Belong Adam.
That's correct.
Which I believe you have not written for since 2010.
That sounds about right. I don't know, the golden age of blogging kind of got usurped by the other social media out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just tell people, what was this blog that,
Well, let's see. What it was is that Blog Belong Adam, the name actually comes from Puck Pigeon, which is essentially pidgin English as spoken in New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
And I think specifically Papua New Guinea. And the idea, and that's how they form possessives. Like, instead of saying Adam's blog,
mm-hmm.
they would say Blog Belong Adam, as in, you know, it's adapting it from English. Blog belonging to Adam. So, it's the only piece of talk business I speak, so I'm not, if you have, you know, listeners from New Guinea who are natives, perhaps, speak talk to them as their native language, I'm sorry, I cannot translate for them. But anyway, you know, it was basically one of these personal blogs. I would talk about, I've kind of carried over the same approach to a certain extent over into, you know, I guess I'm fairly active on Facebook. I post things there. And what I do is, you know, I find news articles that I find interesting, or I'll come across, you know, I'll spend my time, you know, searching around on Wikipedia, and I just come across things there. And, you know, that'll inspire me, and I'll have some sort of a thought, and then, you know, back when I had the blog, I would more carefully craft what I would say about something. I would take the effort to, you know, carefully select photos and place them just so within the text, and then italicize names of movies or things like that, and then get the right quote, and then, you know, that'll devolve with Facebook, where it just became, you know, so easy just to, you know, share a link and then just make some sort of, you know, smash and grab comment, you know, like, oh, hey, how about this? And so, you know, obviously, you know, the level of discourse has fallen, but I hope to keep this. But anyway, as far as the subject matter, I mean, you know, I'm interested in geography, I'm interested in culture and movies and history and I'm a city planner, so that's what I have a lot of things up about that. Travel, I like travel. It broadens your horizons, as the cliche goes. And what I didn't have a lot of is that I didn't have a lot about my personal life. And I think that basically, up until we recently had a baby. My wife was the one who gave birth, and, you know, the both of us have the baby. I know the terminology there. Basically, just back in December. And, you know, so I'll post updates about the baby and everything like that. Before that, though, I think that I more or less deliberately avoided posting things about my personal life. I think some of it is because I saw a lot of other people doing it, and I thought it was a little tedious. So, I would find all these other things, and then about the world that I thought were interesting, and I'd post them, and then, right-wing. I keep people with political views that are divergent from my own on my friends list, and, you know, sometimes conversation gets a little heated. I've seen some people that are like, oh, you know, if you voted for Romney or whatever, then you're no friend of mine. I'm going to drop you from my list. And, you know, if I did that, then I'd have to, I mean, a lot of these people are relatives of mine or, you know, people that I went to high school with and friends of mine there, you know, they're friends of mine regardless of, you know, how they feel about politics or whatever. And, you know, some of it's just, you know, it'd be kind of boring to just be in an echo chamber where everybody agrees with everybody else all the time. That's how I feel.
You're mentioning how you don't like to reveal much about your personal life. I mean, I understandable how there are boundaries that you have to, give for yourself. You know, there are things that you may not want to reveal online or whatnot. But just like you made a point that you said it might be tedious. I mean, you personally feel that you don't have that exciting a life to make any points about online?
I don't know, some of that is that, you know, once it did have the baby, I mean, you know, the life did become a lot more exciting. But at least to me, I don't know, you know, some other people, you know, like, oh, people always post some pictures of their kids or whatever. I don't know how you feel about that or other people feel about that. It's got, you know, I got a good amount of positive feedback on that. You know, and some of that is kind of why we decided to have a kid. It was because at least this is kind of what I feel. I don't want to put words into my wife's mouth. I kind of felt like I got too comfortable. I mean, we're both gainfully, you know, steadily employed, professional jobs, and, you know, we're living in our apartment, and we're, you know, we were able to pay our bills and everything and go on vacations, like, for example, to Paris. We'd spend the weekend sometimes, you know, we'd just be catching up on sleep, and then you sit around and you watch TV, or I'd go on the internet or whatever, and I'd search around on the internet, and then maybe we'd go out and we'd get something to eat, and maybe go see a movie or whatever. And it's like, you know, it was a very comfortable life, but I kind of felt like it wasn't very fulfilling. Like, you know, like people would write about, you know, I don't know, some people would write about things and I thought they were tedious, and then other things people would write about would seem like, wow, look at this person, they're doing all these amazing things. And meanwhile, I'm like, I watched like 4 episodes of Law and Order SVU today. How about that? And, so anyway, now, of course, I have an abundance of not being comfortable, you know, with the, you know, once you have a baby, I mean, you know, your life is no longer your own. You have to, you know, the amount of time that you have to do anything else is very rare. But, you know, it's one of these things where there's this, there's the happiness that you get from being comfortable, and then there's, you know, the deeper, whatever you call it, the Greek, I don't know what the Greek word for it is. Anyway, the Greeks had some, I think they had some kind of idea of, you know, happiness being, striving for like a deeper meaning in life or whatever. I think it's there to a certain extent. You know, it's, fatherhood is not the, you know, it's certainly not a old cherry, that's for sure. It was really tough for me the first, it was really tough for me the first week. The first week, I was a nutcase. I was not handling it well. I was breaking down and crying. I was just like, I was filled with all these negative thoughts. I was just full of despair. I was just like, you know, what have I gotten myself into here? And it was just
very
overwhelming.
You find that to be more of just like fear and panic? Because what you're saying, the primary reason you had a kid was to give your life some purpose. Like, you didn't feel that you were living a life that was meaningful. So he said, like, maybe if I have a kid, you know, that you, it's almost like you just, like, somebody told you, hey, have a kid, it'll make you, you know, feel whole or something. And then when you have it, you get this thing like, oh, what is, you know, get like that opening night regrets.
Yeah, oh, yeah, totally. And it was, you know, people tell you it's hard work. And, but, and I was thinking ahead to how much work it would be, it was more than I had imagined. It was just completely overwhelming. It took quite a while for me to adjust to the idea that I really just needed to refocus, like, you know, my day-to-day thoughts on, okay, you know, what is, you know, getting the baby fed, what is the next thing we need to do here, what is the next thing we need to do there, etc. And so, you know, some of it is that obviously after the first, you know, as the baby gets a little older, the baby gets, you know, inherently, you know, less fussy in some ways. I guess they peak at fussiness around 6 weeks or something like that. And then, you know, they're easier to take care of in certain ways and this and that, and you get used to things and you know, you learn how to deal with it, but, and then, in another sense, being able to handle it better after a couple months in is kind of just a matter of, realigning your own perception of things. I mean, I first noticed this fairly early on, where if the baby woke up in the middle of the night screaming, you know, she needed her diaper change, she needed to be fed, whatever. And it was like 4 a.m., and maybe I'd been asleep for an hour and a half or something, and it was just awful. It was just, what is going on here? And then if that happens in the middle of the day, I was, you know, able to handle it. And eventually I was figuring out that, like, you know, the baby is not doing anything worse, you know, in the middle of the night. It's just my perception of it is worse because I'm so tired in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And then gradually, that can be, you know, it's been, you know, the baby can be fussy or crying or whatever, and at this point, I more or less just kind of accept it instead of despairing over it anymore. You know, it's still a lot of work, and it's still, you know, I wish a lot for the life I used to have in some ways, you know, the comfortable one where I could sit in my bedroom and read my comic books or something like that, or, you know, go out and look at CDs to buy or whatever. And, you know, I don't have that kind of freedom anymore. But, you know, I can at least see the light at the end of the tunnel. You know, it's still a lot of work, but it's not as stressful and fearful and despairing and, you know, all the various other negative emotions. But that's not so much anymore. We also moved into a new house, too. We bought a house. We closed escrow on the house 18 hours and 10 minutes after the baby was born. Mm-hmm. So all the time up to the birth, we were trying to do all of the hassle with going through a short sale and signing all of this and that, and paying, you know, buttloads of money. And then so like 5 or 6 weeks in after the baby was born, which happens to coincide with the fussiest period for the babies, I guess, is when we moved, and that, of course, was stressful there, and then we've been putting the house together. On the one hand, I'm like, ooh, look at me. I'm like, you know, I'm a homeowner and a father and all that kind of stuff, but it's been a very eventful, very stressful 3 months. it's getting better. It's gradually getting better. I feel churlish for complaining about things when I can think about, you know, like with the baby, with fatherhood and such. Right? I can think about, okay, you know, our baby is totally healthy. We're, you know, we have jobs where we can take time off. You know, we don't have to worry about, you know, am I gonna pay the gas bill, or am I gonna be able to feed the baby? We don't have to worry about that. And then, you know, we have help from my parents, from her parents. You know, when I think about, you know, there's single moms out there. There's people having to raise their kids all on their own, people with their kids with birth defects or whatever. And it's just, wow, you know, if people to it, learning how to deal with it. It's tough either way. It helps you appreciate, you know, your parents, you know, what they did to raise you a lot better. Anyway, so that's that. That's me, and that's my life and my personal updates as far as that goes.
I get the sense that with the baby. Oh, wait, did you tell us if it's a boy or a girl? Is it, what is it again?
Girl.
And how old is she?
She is, she'll be, I think, like 12 weeks tomorrow.
12 weeks.
So, it's about a week short of 3 months.
Mm-hmm. And, what's the kid's name?
Katie. Catherine.
And this has me thinking. You mentioned how just realize that you can't do a lot of things that you did, like read comic books or get CDs. Which I love that, you know, live in LA, you can still do that, get CDs.
Yeah.
Amoeba Music. You go to.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm one of these people. I'm one of these old fogies who actually still like to own music in, you know, physical form. I don't know, you know, I grew up on it, and then, I like getting the CDs there, and then you have something so that you don't have to worry about your computer crashing and losing your music collection or something like that, and it's nice to have the physical thing there too, I think. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, I guess that's the world, of course, has turned away from that. Unlike when I go and I get new music, and it's like, you know, stuff from, you know, say the Chemical Brothers or something, you know, who were, you know, most active in the 90s, and then I get like their new albums and such. I'm like, you know, I'm like the guy when I was, you know, when I was a young man, you know, I'd be like the old baby boomer with the gray ponytail, you know, this new Eagles album is great. You know, I recognize that that's the guy I am now. Mm. Except, you know, another generation further along.
Well, I mean, it got me thinking just how your perception of culture has changed since, you know, you're now a father. Because, you know, just that was kind of one of the things that I believe that's the reason why my friend had your blog on his blog. I mean, you wrote about a lot of things regarding culture, mostly movie reviews. You did a lot of those in your time. I think that's, you know, people who read you kind of had this sense that you were this culturally with it guy. And it just had me thinking, because when I was thinking about talking to you before this, I'm like, I was thinking, what exactly are we going to talk about? Because it seems that you've had this gradual disconnect from that, like even way before you had a child. It's just it just seemed
yeah.
that.
I think that's true, and I kind of sense that in my own self. It's kind of weird. I mean, I used to. You know, there was a good decade there where I was a frequent moviegoer, and I would write about them a lot, and I would see, you know, go out of my way to see, you know, foreign movies or you know, revival stuff or things like that. And then that kind of withered away. But it withered away, you know, long before I had the baby.
Yeah.
It was really kind of, it maybe kind of coincided with when I went back to school and I got a master's degree between 02 and 06.
What was your master's in?
Urban and regional planning.
Yeah, where'd you get that?
At Cal Poly Pomona. Mm-hmm. It's a state school here. It actually was pretty cool because I was still working full time at the time, so. It was a program that was geared towards working adults, and, you know, so it was in the evenings, like two nights a week, and basically it meant that I was really busy. It was, you know, I guess maybe before the baby, it was the previous time that I had been really busy. There was a time when I was Valley geography, but I was living in Long Beach. And then I had an internship with the city of Pico Rivera that I had to start at like 7:30 or 7:45 in the morning or something like that. So I did that for half a day. And then at lunch, I was getting lunch and going over to my previous full-time job, which is now just an afternoon-only job. I mean, I'm blessed to have a boss who's understanding and let me go half-time there. In my old job when I was actually an engineer making universal remote controls. So I did that in the afternoon, and then that would go until about 5 or so, and then I would drive from there up to Pomona in rush hour traffic across Orange County, which, you know, if you're unfamiliar with LA geography, just, you know, rest assured it's not fun. So I would have class there maybe sometimes until 10 p.m., and then I would sometimes go visit my wife now, the girlfriend then. She was living in Pasadena. She was in school, too. Generally I'd go over to her house and say, hey, Jen, how you doing? And then I would fall asleep. And at some point I would, you know, shuffle on home. And, you know, it was a pretty busy time. But, and so at that point, I basically couldn't really keep up on movies anymore.
Yeah.
I think that's more or less when, you know, there was a while when I was still going, I was buying, you know, time on weekends or whatever, and then eventually it's just, you know, that and, you know, school and work and everything, you know, all of a sudden I wasn't just this, you know, guy doing a 9-to-5 job and then, you know, every evening. I mean, it used to be, you know, I'd work during the day, and then every evening it'd be like, well, okay, what do I do now? I guess I'll go out and see a movie or whatever. But, you know, then eventually, you know, you go home, and then it's like, it's not just me going out to see a movie now. It's like me and my wife, and, you know, we gotta think about things and all that. So, I don't know. You know, it's a... I haven't been engaged in culture as much that way, you know. I try to read. I mentioned earlier that I like to you know, poke around on, like, say, Wikipedia and stuff a lot, and that's an outgrowth of something that I've done all my life, really, is I've been, you know, a trivia guy. I like finding out facts. When I was a kid, I would read the almanac or the dictionary or, you know, go through an atlas. I still do that, you know, find things there, find geography, just facts about the world. And, you know, when I was a kid, you know, you get these books, they were just like, I remember I had this one called The Big Book of Amazing Facts. And, boy, I love that stuff. And then eventually, you know, I my trivia led me to appearing on Win Ben Stein's Money and on Jeopardy. So, you know, trivia. It'll get good at trivia and, you know, read dictionaries and encyclopedias and stuff all the time, and then you too can appear on the basic cable with Jimmy Kimmel, and then end up with the luck of the draw facing 74-time champion Ken Jennings in his 61st episode on Jeopardy, and do very impressively against him. But not impressively enough to actually beat him. That's what I did.
well, I guess, yeah, this is a good time, if any, to talk about...
I'm champ on Jeopardy. I was up against him.
Yes, and so... I think it's a good time, if any, to talk about those experiences where you were on those games.
Win Ben Stein, okay, both of them involve, you know, you go in, taking a test, and, you know, to get into the contestant pool. And then the thing was that Win Ben Stein Money, it was a lot, you know, quicker as far as, you take the test, and then you're essentially in the contestant pool, and then you go. Whereas Jeopardy, there was more casting involved.
Mm-hmm.
So, some people don't necessarily understand is that to get on the show, what happens on Jeopardy, is that a group of people goes to the studios there. I mean, you know, the there's other things. They have the mobile, you know, they have various events around the country where they test out contestants. But basically how this worked for me was that a group of people, maybe about 100 people or so, go to the studio, where they film the show, and you all go and you take a written test. It's 50 questions. And then they go and they take everybody's answer sheets away, and everybody kind of sits around and goes around going, oh, I don't know, how did you do? How about that one question? How about this? And then they come back and they just tell you who passed. Now, very famously, they don't tell you what your score was, and they don't tell you what the score needed to pass was. So, basically, you just know that maybe about, you know, a fraction, you know, maybe about 15%, I think it was, maybe 20% of the people pass the test, and they call you up and we're like, oh wow, I'm in the contestant pool. Well, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean at that point that you're going to be on the show. What happens there is that they then play like a mock version of the game where they're just going to see how well you would appear on camera. You know, stand up there and you stand up straight. Do you enunciate well, or do you sit there and fidget and talk real slow and that kind of a thing? And at that point, what they're doing is that they're casting for a TV show. You know, they want to see a mix of people. They want to see interesting people. I mean, it's not to the same extent that they are on, like, say, like Wheel of Fortune. Hey, are you there?
Yeah, I'm just,
okay,
yeah.
Okay.
I'm working on my ice pack on my knee. That's basically what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alright, you know, so like on Wheel of Fortune, obviously, they're just looking for people who will smile and clap and you know, go, woo, I'm gonna spin the wheel! You know, there's a lot of nerds on Jeopardy. I mean, it's kind of how it goes. But they try to mix it up some. Like, they try to, you'll notice sometimes they have contestants where they say, you know, so-and-so, official contestant, originally from Silver City, New Mexico. Well, that person actually isn't the third person when I was up on the show. You know, she lived in Washington, D.C., or at the time she lived in Washington, D.C., and it's just not as interesting to go up there and say, here we have somebody from Washington, D.C., but if they come up there and they say, here we have somebody from Silver City, New Mexico, that's more interesting.
Well, I mean, was she born in Silver City, or she wasn't even from Silver City?
She was from Silver City, you know, it's where she grew up and that kind of a thing. But, you know, she's been a naval officer and, you know, working in the, I don't know, intelligence community or defense or something. I'm not sure exactly what that woman did, but, you know, she's working in Washington, D.C., you know, so they don't want to have everybody just going up there and being, oh, here's so-and-so from Los Angeles, California. Here's so-and-so from Glendale, California. So-and-so from Long Beach, California. They want geographic diversity. They want, you know, men and women, all sorts of things.
I mean, what was the rap they gave you? What was the backstory they gave you?
You know, I was, at the time, I was just an engineer from Long Beach, California. That's what it was. But, I think that I maybe I spoke clearly and such. And you know, they tell you to prepare five things that are interesting about you. And the one that I went with was that I'd been in a band where I played, pots and pans for percussion and that kind of a thing. This was the band Steel Urine. That my friends and I had been in, that we formed in college, and then after we graduated, you know, we'd get together periodically afterwards, and the band had two accordions, two guitarists, the original formation of the band, two accordions, two guitarists, and then two of us were percussionists, meaning that we would just improvise from anything. Lots of pots and pans, trash cans. I remember, after we graduated, one guy was living in Philadelphia. We went over, we had a show at an art gallery there that he had set up the day after Christmas in 1997. And we went, another guy and I him, and then we, our first day, and we took us into Philadelphia, and we just drove around near the Delaware River in the industrial area looking for junk. And eventually, you know, we found like this muffler assembly from a car, and we, oh yeah, that's a good one. Put that into the van, and then we banged on that when we performed.
So you're riffing about this on Jeopardy? That was you were talking with Al Trebek about your former life as a percussionist in this band?
Yeah, exactly. And that was in fact what they went with on the show when they go and they tell you and they meet people, they meet people, and so I talked about being on the band that way.
So yeah, and so you were on. You on the show just once, or were you on other times, or just?
Just once. It's that's one of the things is that you go up there and you've got one chance. You either win your game and become the new Jeopardy champion, or you lose, in which case that's it. You know, there's no going back.
Yeah.
I was on Jeopardy in 2004. That was during the Ken Jennings run.
Yeah.
And then
how was he? Was he getting big headed at that time, or was he what?
No, he's a good guy. I've met him since, and I had actually met him before. I had competed against him in Quiz Bowl when I was in college, and he was in college at the same time. He was representing BYU, and we played against each other a couple of times. And for somebody who's kind of my nemesis. Because honestly, if I'd been going up against, most other people, if it hadn't been him as my opponent, I really felt like I could have won, multiple times. So, am I bitter about that? Yeah, I guess I am. But, there's only so much you can do. I wanted to, I knew he was who I was up against, and, I took that challenge, and, I got close, but I didn't beat him. But
you made it up to Final Jeopardy, right? And just you remember the answer that they gave you in Final Jeopardy?
Oh yeah. I remember like it was yesterday. Went into Final Jeopardy. Now, if you remember from Ken Jennings' run, he was really good. He was good with the buzzer, and that was the thing that killed you. By the time I was up there, he had been there 61 episodes, so he was very, very comfortable with. Hitting the buzzer and that kind of a thing and in that way. So, a lot of times I knew the answer to the question, but he was able to ring in, right. He had the timing right on when to ring in.
Yeah.
Because you have to wait until Alex Bish is reading it and then a little light comes on and then you can ring in. He had that rhythm down perfectly. But anyway, nevertheless, going into Final Jeopardy, a lot of the times it was a runaway. He would have more than twice as much as the next opponent, which meant that he basically relaxed and, he could bet a small enough amount so that it didn't matter if he knew if he got the Final Jeopardy answer right or wrong. But in my case, he had about $25,000. I had about, I think it was $17,400.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third place contestant, she was still in it, too. This is the naval officer lady from Silver City, New Mexico, Mary Hamilton Allen, was her name. And she had about $12,000. So she was still in the mix. So it was a pretty competitive game. My parents said that they'd been sitting directly behind Ken's wife, Mindy, and she had been, by that point, she was getting tired of watching the show so much, so she'd been doing like her crocheting or knitting or something like that. And as our episode went on, she actually put her knitting down and watched the show because it was getting competitive.
Mm-hmm.
But so anyway, going in, he had about 25,000, I had 17,000. So if I had been right and he had been wrong, I would have beaten him. But so the Final Jeopardy category was population. And the gist of the question was to name the independent country on the South American mainland with the lowest population. Would you like to hazard a guess?
No, I don't know. Go ahead.
Okay. The answer is Suriname. which formerly Dutch Guiana. You know, there's like Guyana, you know, French Guiana, and formerly Dutch Guiana. It's now Suriname. But it's up on the northern coast there, next to Venezuela, in between like Venezuela and Brazil, there, the Caribbean coast. But anyway, that was the answer. I figured it out. I knew it was going to be one of those ones, and I went with the Dutch one. And Ken said that he was trying to choose between Guyana and Suriname, and he went with Suriname. He spelled it wrong, but you don't get penalized for spelling. But, yeah, so he got it right, and I got it right. He was in first place. He went on for another 14 episodes, and I went home with second place, $2,000, and there you go.
That was a great moment in the sun. I mean, did you win Ben Stein's money?
Yeah. Win Ben Stein's money. I beat Ben. I was the leader going into the final round of the game, and then, you know, it's pretty fun. They put you in a little booth there, and they give you noise canceling muffle headphones, and actually they pipe in the right of the boundary. So you're sitting there in that isolation booth, and they're playing da 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 da. So I'm in there. They asked Ben 10 questions. He got 6 right. They asked me. I got 7 right. I beat him. I won $5,000 of Ben's time's money.
Yeah.
So, and Ben was gracious. He said, if I'm going to lose to someone, just not so bad, leaving to someone as smart as you. Or maybe he said as nice as me. I forget. He either told me I was smart or I was nice. I'm not sure which one.
Mm-hmm.
Memory's hazy.
Well, do people ever recognize you from your appearances on these game shows?
You know, after I was on Ben Stein, I remember, like, I was pumping gas once, and the guy's like, hey, come on, that's show. And I was, oh yeah, yeah, I was. And then Jeopardy, a little bit. I forget if it was just random people on the street, but people brought up, oh yeah, I was watching you and you were on Jeopardy. It's actually kind of an interesting postscript to this whole thing. There's this thing that just started 2 years ago called the Trivia Championships of North America. Where some people, the organized quizzing, which I was only sort of peripherally a part of, I just kind of heard about, and then I got in, but they people who do game shows, and then, pub quizzes around the country, and they try getting, little tournaments here and there around the country, and then they have this thing that's putatively a sort of a national roundup. It's basically just a big convention of trivia nerds, and you play a lot of different formats, games, and things like that, and this has been held in Las Vegas the past couple of years, and I've come to that, and the first time Ken was there, too, I went up, like, oh, hey, Ken, how you doing? Oh, hey, Adam, how are you? Yeah, pretty good. And he's like, hey, when was the last time that I saw you in person? And I was like, he was on the show, Ken. Okay, all right. I see you online. I'm like, well, okay, that's nice to know. Ken Jennings looks me up online from time to time.
You ever thought about doing Millionaire?
I tried out for Millionaire a year after I was on Jeopardy. I tried out, I passed the test, and then they go to the casting part, big cattle call for the test. It was a big full ballroom in Las Vegas, actually, this time. And, I get in the room, and again, like I said, at that point, they're casting for a TV show. Well, I look around at the room, and there were like 30 of us who passed the test, and, a good 3/4 of us are, schlubby-looking white guys in our 30s or 40s or whatever. So I'm like, okay, all right. If I were casting for a TV show, I don't fault them for it or anything. I mean, it's, they want to put they want to have a variety of different people on the show. It's an entertainment show. It's not they're under no obligation to cast you for the show. So at that point, I was like, okay, all right. And I didn't get called for that one. But yeah, I keep thinking I gotta go on again. The game that I, you know, after that, I got into The Amazing Race. Did you ever watch The Amazing Race?
No, I didn't. No, I don't. Okay. No.
It's a good show. Obviously, I mean, as far as quiz shows on TV, I mean, there's hardly any left. You know, Millionaire and Jeopardy are the two big ones, and, you know, every once in a while there's a little small one that they try to bring up. But The Amazing Race, obviously not a quiz show, but I think it's just a great show. It's the format, the pacing, the worst thing about it, though, is the people, they tend to cast much more nice people. But anyway, you watch the show and you see people reacting under lots of stressful situations. They've been away for a long time. They've been traveling for a long time. You put them in these situations where they don't speak the language, stuff like that. And so it's kind of interesting. But anyway, there's always going to be certain kinds certain kinds of challenges. There's going to be stuff where you have to deal with animals. There's going to be something where you have to deal with jumping out of, you know, something tall and heights and that sort of thing. You're going to have to drive a stick shift car. Some people, that's the simplest thing. You watch the show and sometimes you see people, they just get, you know, they end up losing a round because they can't drive a stick shift. And you're like, oh my God, I can't believe you go on this show and you don't take the time to learn how to drive a stick shift. You know you're going to have to drive. I brought this up with you a while ago, recently, but you're also going to have to do something in the water. You're going to have to swim. And a couple weeks ago, the guys who ended up getting booted from that episode were these two black guys who were identical twins. They were doctors. Both of them were, and they're going through everything fine. They get to the water task where they're supposed to, you know, swim underneath the water and find some stuff at the bottom of this lagoon or whatever. And they totally froze up. They're totally in fear. They're like, oh, let's skip the task and take the 4-hour penalty. And you know, the one brother, it's a, you know, no, don't just, we gotta try this. But they were really struggling with it. And I'm watching this and I'm thinking, oh man, this is just totally playing down to the stereotypes. You know, there needs to be some sort of a big effort to get more black people to learn how to swim. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I can't swim, so...
Okay.
Yeah. I think a huge part of that is that there's not a lot of pools in the inner cities.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I know... I'm not going to say I know why, but I mean, I can see why. I mean, you know, for so many years, for so many years, I mean, the pools would be outright segregated. I mean, you know, they didn't want to let people, you know, black people swim. And so it wasn't part of the culture, and, you know, and then you can see how that persists. But it's one of these things where it's like, you know, man, you know, there has to be, to overcome that, you know, it's like with anything involving, you know, the history of racism and Jim Crow and, you know, civil rights and everything, it's not like, you know, the Civil Rights Act passes in 1965, and then bam, all of a sudden there's no more racism and everything's hunky-dory. You know, there's still these lingering effects, and, you know, obviously it's not as big of a deal as, you know, poverty or, you know, racism in the housing market or some pregnancy or things like this. Obviously those are much bigger deals. But it seems like the sort of thing that could be addressed, like, you know, if people just put their minds to it, you know, I don't know, there could be somebody could have a national campaign to, you know, pools in the inner city, pools let's have, you know, black people should be crippled by not knowing how to swim. That's how I feel.
So because you saw two black people on a reality show,
yeah,
who didn't know how to swim,
right,
you feel there should be some sort of initiative to
well, you know, it's it's going off of an anecdote and then generalizing it to society as a whole. But
I'm sure there's a lot of black people who actually know how to swim and stuff like that.
Sure,
but
just
like, it's usually a choice and everything.
There's a guy in the Olympics. There's a guy in the Olympics I remember on the U.S. swim team. Black guy.
So it's like,
not all white people know how to swim. There are plenty of people.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just like, I don't know what the hell is just like, it's just trying to say that just like it's, there should be a program mainly just in case, like, you know, my cousins, they can swim, you know, they had some guy who lived with them that taught them how to swim, I was living in an apartment, and it had a pool, and there would be some Saturdays where my cousin would show up with a couple of his friends and some hoochies they found somewhere. And they would go in the pool and just out of the blue they would just show up at my doorstep, say, hey man, can we use the pool? And actually it's funny because it would scare my roommates because they would see them outside. And I'm just like, who are those people? And I was like, they're my cousins and they come down here for the pool. So just like not every black person on the planet.
Actually, I remember there's an incident when I was a kid. I was about 11 or 12 years old. This was 1985, I remember. And one summer, a neighbor who was a member of the local Elk Club had said, hey, for the summer, if they talked to my mom or my parents, they said, you know, hey, if you guys want to go and use the pool at the Elks Club, and you're welcome to do so. Here's a little, temporary membership unless you guys use that. And I'm like, oh, yeah, great, thanks. So, we would go to this, and sometimes we bring along friends and such. And so one time my sister, my older sister, she brought along one of her friends who was black. And they go to the pool, and the lady who's like the pool attendant at one point there, during the day while she's over there, she calls my mom over and says, hey, in the future, we prefer it if you didn't bring anybody who was black to the pool. And, my mom was just flabbergasted at this, my dad grew up in the South, during segregation time, so this is Long Beach, California in 1985, it wasn't Mississippi in the 50s or 60s, this shit still happened, or it did then, I'm sure it lingered today. We didn't go back. Let's put it that way.
It's interesting how this all came about, because you're watching a TV show where two black men were competing in it, in a reality show, and they couldn't learn how to swim. It's just like, as you mentioned, it's just perpetuating a stereotype and just make you decide that there should be some kind of national program to have black people to swim, even though just like, I'm pretty sure a lot of them can swim. And just like,
I'm
some
sure
people
can
swim and some people...
I'm sure. I don't want to, when I went into this, and I knew this is one of the things we're going to talk about, I didn't want to be like Quentin Tarantino, thinking that he's all like chummy and, in with the black community and speak for them. He thinks he's part of them, even though he's not. And, I didn't want to be that guy. But it's something I saw, and it started me thinking. So,
when you gave me that email about what you saw, I was just like, oh man, he's playing with a loaded gun here, pretty much, because like you can, especially I love it when white people bring up racial matters or racial issues, with another black person, or just with anybody in general, because just like it sets off this conversation where, because, listen, I love, talking about race. I love talking about race with black people. I love talking race with white people, especially with white people, especially with old white people, because they don't even give a fuck anymore. Yeah. They'll be completely honest. I mean, you know, a lot of people who've been on this podcast, they listened to the Victor Morton episode, the first one I did, and one of the reasons I did that episode was because because Victor's not only a cool guy to talk to about a lot of subjects, but he's an old white Republican, and if I bring up race with him, I mean, he's gonna be completely honest or anything, and he's gonna be completely honest and be this. It's very interesting conversation having with somebody, having an honest discussion about race, and it's like it's one of those things where even if it brings up some sort of stereotype or something, he's willing to listen and just like have this discourse. I think the big problem is when people bring up stuff like you just saying, like the black people in swimming. It could be perceived as, a lot of people wouldn't want to bring that up because it would seem racist, even though there would be some truth to it, because like I just said, the inner cities didn't have pools. I did not have a pool. Then again, I didn't have anybody to teach me how to swim. There's that too. And so, there's a lot of things come into why there are black people that don't swim. There are those like my cousin and other people, and I don't know if you remember that movie Pride with Terrence Howard, where he played a swimming coach and he was starting an all black swim team, I believe in Philadelphia, Bernie Mac was helping them, and they were trying to defeat the evil white swim coach, which was for some reason played by Tom Arnold, and so it just. And you just said there was a black person on the Olympic swim team. So just like it's not a common thing that it's not like all black people. You can't really just you gotta make sure it's not. And you have the old idea what you said. You said that you grew up and a lot of people had segregated pools and people didn't want people in their pools and all that stuff. Yeah. And I mean, I remember, all the stories of Dorothy Dandridge, being banned from swimming pools in the hotels and stuff where she was performing. And if she did swim in the pool, they would have to disinfect it and shit. But it still is just like, we've managed to come a long way to the point where it's kind of like it became a choice right now. There's some, black people who don't want to swim and some black people who can swim. And it's just like a thing. I mean, I don't know if there's been a survey where we can detect the population.
I don't know if there's stats on that anywhere.
Yeah.
I remember I was talking to some guys who've been in the Navy, and they said when you're just going to basic training, they do send you through, and they see if you know how to swim, and if they don't, then they give you a crash course in swimming. So I don't know if the military keeps stats on that or anything. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's like if there is an exact number, what is the population of black people in the continental United States who can swim and all that? I don't know if it's like a large number or a small number, but I know that. There are people.
I guess there's also the question of where do you draw the line on can or cannot swim? What if someone, they can stay afloat, but they can't swim all that well,
Really? That's you think whether black people can stay afloat?
Well, no, not that. But I mean, say if somebody can't swim.
Yeah.
Do they mean that they're just not a strong swimmer? Or do they mean that they, seriously have no idea what to do in the water? I guess that's the distinction I'm trying to make.
Okay. Well, I always thought if swimming was often a thing where just like you learned how to swim, and once you learned how to swim, you knew how to swim, unless you like, Michael Phelps or Mark Spitz or whoever. Yeah.
It's kind of like riding a bicycle.
Yeah, exactly. It's not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's people out there who don't know how to ride bicycles. I don't know.
I guess.
I don't think I'm a very good bicyclist. That's one thing I gotta tell you. I don't know how to work gears on a bicycle. I know I've had them explained to me before, and you use a low gear for when you need more power, you're going up the hill, and then I'm like, I don't even know, what's a low gear here, and then what is it supposed to do? I'm just spinning my wheels faster, and I'm screw it, I'm just gonna get off and walk my bike up the hill. That's how it always ended up with me if I was trying to bike.
I'm from Texas, so when I had a bike, it's like nothing but flatlands down there. So you rarely use the gears for anything. It wasn't until I came here to North Carolina where there's hills and peaks and valleys and all that shit.
Yeah.
So that's the hills I keep hearing about. Do you have any other questions about black people that you need to? Need some ask, if you need some discussing or just because the black people swimming thing that was kind of an issue with you.
Well, I knew that would make for a fiery discussion. I don't know. Do you have any questions about white people you'd like to ask me?
No. Because first off, if I have a question about white people, I'll ask white people.
That's the thing, is that it's easier for you to see white culture because, it's all around you. I have to go out and, find, a black person and say, oh, hi, you're a black gentleman. How do you feel about the swimming issue? But, it's not symmetrical.
Of course, you have to understand, despite the fact that, every now and then you hear those reports saying that white people are constantly dwindling in population and making them not necessarily the majority, but they're still the alpha males of the
whole crew. There's the cultural norm. I remember somebody told me that there's a term, they called it the invisible norm.
Yeah.
And nobody ever laid it out and said if you're going to talk about somebody, then it's like how if somebody's describing somebody, they might mention something that's unusual about the person. He's very tall.
He's
short. Well, there's this implicit thing where, a lot of times, they might mention the fact that the guy's black. He's black, but they don't feel like they need to mention it. It's white. And that's just that whole mindset just tells you that there's such a person. There's a person in the United States. Okay, all right. And then they figure that this person is going to be an adult, they're going to be able body, they're going to, et cetera, et cetera. And then if they go and start describing someone, they go with something that, supposedly sets them apart. And if you grow up in a society where being black is the thing that sets you apart from, quote, the norm, then that's gotta, psychologically that tells you, oh, I'm not part of that norm. It's not, we're not living in a, rainbow wonderland.
Well, it's just this thing where, it's not when you ask, do I have any questions about white people? I don't, primarily because it's just a general thing that we all know a lot of things. We all just know so much more about white people because you feel like you have to know a lot about white people. I mean, it's practically imparted in you and through the culture. And I often, I'm trying to see, telling black people or other minorities, you should know a lot about white people. You need to know who you're up against and everything.
Yeah.
Funny thing, being in my position where I was and writing about arts and culture, which is not generally seen as a vocation that most black people appear to be in.
Which, if you think about it, is kind of crazy considering how much American culture comes from black culture. I mean, you know.
Yeah, but still, it's just when you go. I think I was bitching about this with somebody. When I did another podcast recently, where I just talked about how, as a black man, when you go to certain places like nightclubs or certain formal events or certain things, and you're there, and you say you're covering it for a paper, and they get a little nervous, get a little antsy, and they have problems with how you handle things, and you're not handling with the decorum or some shit that they don't, and everything. So it's you have this sense that you're constantly surrounded by white culture, and therefore you know a lot more about white culture than they know about black culture. It's gotten to a point where it's just like this thing where white culture really doesn't feel, especially older white culture, I say middle-aged white culture, just don't feel they have to know a lot more about other cultures. I mean, I think younger generations definitely are more tuned into black culture than older generations. Just like, if I hear one more white person tell me they don't like R&B, I'm gonna like slap the shit out of somebody. Like, it's real nothing about R&B. You don't like anything.
I think if you look at popular music, if you look at like say the Billboard Top 40, the Billboard Top 10, 30 years, in the 70s or 80s, it was dominated by essentially, there was pop music and rock music and that sort of thing, but the pop music was essentially pop music that kind of came out of rock music to a certain extent. And then hip-hop came along, and then, maybe you don't, think about it now, but, there's pop music, but there's very little rock music in the top 40 pop songs, etc. There's very little rock, and then there's, some hip hop, and of course everything that makes it to the top 40 is going to be, diluted in some way. It's the mass production version of something that, 10 years ago was something, more underground or whatever. But you can see that a lot of the language and stuff, even something like Katy Perry. Okay, Katy Perry, I'm not going to say Katy Perry's black. She's not. Totally not. But, the beats behind her music are, it's the emphasis there. You can draw a little line from hip-hop and the use of drum machines and synthesizers to provide the melody and that sort of thing, leading it to there. I'm not gonna be one of these crazy people who tries to say she's hip hop or anything like that. I'm just using her as an example. But if you look at the musical part of her music, it comes more from that end than, the old days where you would have like a pop song, it'd be like, say like the Archie. Sugar, sugar, or whatever like that. It's like, it's a pop song, it's a cheesy bubblegum pop song, but the music is guitar and bass and drums and that sort of thing. Hip hop kind of changed the core assumption, that the basis of popular music, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's just, it's something. I think it's more about it just seems that we now gotten into this whole thing where it just seems to be a convergence of different sounds and genres, and just, In a sense, popular music has become something more of a melting pot.
Yeah.
I'm just listening to Justin Timberlake's new album, and it's just...
Oh, man, I haven't listened to that yet, yeah.
And just, he throws in... I mean, for most part, it's like R&B, and just, it's mostly R&B. It's like, it's old school R&B, it's new school R&B, it's Frank Ocean sound R&B. It's, he throws in some Latin stuff, and he does some dance tracks, the whole big bag of stuff. So just like, it's rarely it seems that, I think it's mostly, it's mostly derived from just a lot of other influences. And just it kind of goes to just how much, because it's not just, because it goes back to what I was saying, just had this general sense that since white culture was kind of the norm, the major equivalent that you're supposed to appeal. In the music, you're supposed to appeal to like a white base, but as years progressed and just Motown and Stax and disco and hip hop and just like a lot of other different you got all these different genres of music and so it's not just one type of thing anymore. I mean, if you listen to a lot of people's music, I've been talking on and off with different artists, and many of them are these artists that say that they don't have one style of music. It's gotten to the point now, they get insulted if you ask them what is their style of music. It's gotten to that point, they want to be seen as unclassifiable. They want to be seen as eclectic and...
if you have somebody who is, then who is definitely, in one niche, one corner, then it's almost like they're making a conscious effort to be a throwback and I'm going to resist everything that's outside of, this one little narrow thing that I am. And, there aren't many of those people around anymore. You'll notice it if you listen to some new music and you're, oh, wow, this person's definitely adapting a style of a, early 80s synth pop. It's a deliberate effort on their part. You feel like if people are making a deliberate effort to ape one particular style, then it'll be this sort of more universal style that incorporates more different things.
Jamie Liddell. You know who Jamie Liddell is? He dropped a new album, and it's exactly what you just described. It's 80s synth pop, but done in a more... it's like especially 80s Prince-style synth pop, and it's kind of like done in a very... Of course, done in a more contemporary manner, especially considering, EDM and dubstep and all that. So definitely, if you listen to his music... You'll get that 80s influence, but also, you get some contemporary sounds as well.
And you have to, if you just go out there and just start playing music these days, then you'll hear a song you like, and you're like, okay, I want to do something like that, or I want to do something like this, and they'll be all over the map, Unless you're one of these people who's just very self-consciously going after one particular thing.
It's funny because it's almost like every form of music now is pop music because it's just all consuming. I mean, nobody seems to be appealing to one type of audience. It seems to be. Just like this general thing where it's just they're just mashing it all up. We're basically living in an age where it's like music is being extremely mashed up, but not really because mashups are one thing. But it seems that music is being made in kind of a mashup fashion. The funny thing is we're going on about all this stuff in the culture, and we kind of started this thing wondering, are you still in deep into the culture?
I realized half an hour into this conversation that I was talking all about myself. I was just like, oh, man, I must be boring people.
Well, you know, I didn't want to say anything. It's just that, but once again, like, but I mean, it wasn't your point, just that, you know, as a person that it almost seems like it, as you were talking, it sort of seems like you've just given up. And there was a point where I was just like, okay, he's kind of like, kind of doing this major adult thing, talking about being a father and having this this life and everything. And I'm just like, and for a lot of people that would sound quite dull, because I know for a lot of people, just like nobody, you have no idea how many people I know who really don't want to grow the hell up, and. I'm trying not to be one of them, but it's just this thing where it's just like people, you know, when you get into that whole sense of domesticity, almost a conformist sense of just who you're supposed to be, because like you talked about, you know, you basically had a child to gain some purpose in your life, and you have this thing now, so you're just like in this point, almost this idea of general contentment. So yeah. It doesn't seem to be, you know, doesn't seem to be like much else. Like usually when I go on this podcast, I like hearing people talk about crazy stuff they've done. Just
here's kind of maybe a little postscript to this whole thing. I think one of the interesting things is as my kid grows up, then I'll have, you know, this young person who's 39 years younger than me, who's going to be, you know, she's going to be engaged in pop culture as a young person, I'm sure, and so I'll be able to see things to a certain extent through her eyes. And, you know, so, you know, 15 years from now or whatever, whatever teenagers are listening to 15 years from now, when I'm 54, I'll be aware of it. Which I wouldn't probably as a 54-year-old otherwise.
Yeah, well, you had something to look forward to, you and your daughter, button heads about various things. Oh, that's gonna be some fun teen years. You ever think about that? It's just like, just got a daughter, and she's probably gonna grow up, and a lot of guys are gonna want to do shit with her and everything. Is just
it's really something to look forward to. You know, every generation, you know, they look at the generation before them and they think, you know, some of it is they you know, oh, I'm not going to do things that way, and some of it is, maybe things in some ways are, maybe some ways are doing things pretty okay.
Yeah,
you kind of got to forge ahead.
I hope
the way it works for you.
I hope you don't go on to be one of those parents who think they have a perfect kid, because that's when.
We don't want to. We're definitely. My wife, she sometimes goes to this thing, this breastfeeding support group, she's like, well, some of those moms in there are super moms, you know, they just, everything has got to be perfect or whatever, and for us, we're happy with whatever works.
Yeah. Well, because let me tell you something, kids can be assholes. It's like, and I'm getting at that age where I'm just like, I'm starting to have those stirrings, like, maybe I could be good at this fatherhood thing. Maybe it's there's something to it. And then I hang out with a kid for a day, and I'm just like, nah, fuck that. I can't, they'll just start crying about stuff that you had nothing to do with. You touch them on the shoulder and they start crying. And thankfully, you'll have those parents who understand, like, yeah, she's always like this. And, like, you don't want to be around children because you don't know how they're going to act. And, of course, since you don't know how they're going to, you don't know how the parents are going to act. And usually the parents are bigger assholes than the children because they can't, they're in this magical cloud where they can't see that their kid's an asshole. So.
Yeah.
I'm basically venting now. I hope you realize that because. Because we're getting to that point. Finally gotten to the point. Because, you know, you said real early, just like you're talking. And just realizing, oh, just okay, this is good. Like, there is that point in most of the podcasts where I start screaming for no reason. And I was actually wondering, was that going to happen in this podcast? Because it just seemed to just have this.
Okay, well, I'm glad that I could bring you to that point.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, well, just.
It wouldn't be a Muskrunner as I know without it, I think. So,
yeah.
I'm glad that I could. Help you achieve what you're going for there.
Yeah, because, shit ain't going well for me, so I need to vent. Just like, because, yeah, I got the kids, I've moved to the new house, it's everything, and you're still city planning.
That's what I mean. I mean, obviously, it's the sort of thing that occupies my mind, and then I'm like, Asma's got a feel for, somebody who doesn't have these things. Like, oh, look, everything's going his way. Oh, and look, he's complaining about having to take care of a baby and having to the house together. Oh, look, here's this world's smallest violin. And that's what I worry about. That's why I feel like,
oh,
man, I'm boring people. And I'm like,
oh,
but, that's what's on my mind these days.
Well, hopeful, good thing is you still know people like me who have nothing going for them and just have, all know all this random shit that, tell you about.
I don't want to lose that. We're in, it's not just a house, it's a house,
you
know, it's a boring conservative suburb.
Yeah. Cause that's the thing I was wondering, like, the reason why you're talking like this, cause you're hanging around, other boring couples with kids. And just.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of, I want to make sure that when my kid grows up, I want to make sure that she, she breaks out of the bubble here, and I'll take her downtown. I'll take her to things, and she'll. I want her to see the city. I want her to see the world. I want her to meet people who are a little off, and because she needs to know that the world isn't all perfect all the time.
Yeah.
And to the extent that things are good, she definitely better be sure to be thankful for it, and not just take that shit for granted.
All right, that's going to be your parenting plan, I see.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Okay, well, do you have any online shout-outs you'd like to give? Like, where can people find you online and everything?
Where can people find me online? Well, my name is Adam Villani, Villani. If you're a friend of Craig, you can friend me, and I'll try not to bore you with my personal life, and I'll try to just edify you with interesting links and things that I music that I find around the world. Although lately, I've just been posting a lot about the World Baseball Classic and then the Hemp People Conclave. So I don't know. You might have to wait a while for me to actually post anything else.
You're not on Twitter, I think.
Technically I have a Twitter account, but it's just that if I do something, I can use it. I don't actually use my own Twitter account much. I have my blog, that blog, the long app, Villong.
Yeah.
It's still up there. You can still find it. It's on Blogspot, blogthelongadam.blogspot.com. Every once in a while I go and I read some of those old articles. I'm like, I think that's some pretty good writing. And, these days I don't have anywhere near the time to write up and stuff. But that's me online.
Yeah.
And you can find my Jeopardy, if you look on Jeopardy Archive.
Yeah.
And my name, you can find like a complete account of all the different questions that were asked on my Jeopardy episode. People keep track of that stuff like box scores and baseball games.
Uh-huh. We should also mention you on Google Plus for some reason.
I do have a Google Plus account. Again, I don't use it much. It's there, for something wanted to do it.
Yeah.
something with it. But, yeah.
What is your Twitter handle, if I may ask? Wait.
It's probably Adam N. Belani. And my middle initial is N as a Neil. So Adam N. Belani, or, you know, it looks like a Dan Belani.
Okay. All right. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's good. Well, was this good enough for you, dude? Just because, yeah, we talked for a good 90 minutes now, so.
Yeah, it was an hour and a half.
Yeah.
I hope people enjoy it. I hope people like listening to it.
Yeah, I hope so, too. Just, I guess.
If they do, they can fast forward.
We'll just see how it goes. I mean, it's cool. I guess, like I said, it was a little conservative at first, but then we started, popping something up. I'm not trying to make it sound like you're dull or anything.
Start off with like some crazy story about, you know, going to Mexico and end up covering cockroaches or anything.
But
I guess that would have been a better lead up. That didn't happen to me.
Oh, you didn't have a story like that. Yeah, well, that's the thing, because, you said you went to Paris, and just, like, I was thinking, here comes some whore talk or something like that. But no, it was just a cool vacation. I was like, oh, okay.
Right, no, yeah, there wasn't an easy one. Went to Philadelphia and picked up junk, so, you know, there's that.
Yeah, but then we get into Jeopardy stuff, and then we got off on the whole black people swimming thing. So, like I said, it's like most conversations that I do in this podcast, especially with people I haven't spoken to really in a while, it kind of has to get to that point when things like get really exciting and really ball grabbing.
It's just kind of the standard, you know, the kind of thing where people, you know, say you're sitting next to somebody on the bus or whatever, and oh, what are you sitting up to? And no, I'm sorry, I just ran the. Dishwasher, the faucet. Yeah, you know, oh, what have you been up to? Oh, well, I'm out of house, and, you know, I go through the stuff, and then we finally started getting into stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And plus, like, it's real late for me. I know it's like you're still a few hours up
in LA. Oh, yeah, it's like midnight over there.
So, yeah, it's like as a person I interviewed recently on the podcast said that, you know, you get the better answers at this late at night for some reason. You get the better questions, the better answers. So I think we got to that point. I'm glad we did. It was fun talking to you. So it wasn't
great.
Yeah. So
good talking to you too.
Yeah, it was so great. So it's great talking to you. But let me close it out real quickly. As always, this is Craig D. Lindsay saying, 1997. The end. All right.